How's it going, everybody, and welcome to episode number 44 of Master My Garden Podcast. Now, this week's episode is one I'm really excited about, actually. It's about a book that has caught my eye over the last kind of month or two. It's An Irish Nature Year by Jane Powers, and it looks like a beautiful book. I have it here. We'll talk about it in a minute. But Jane herself is a nature writer, a columnist, and she has been gardening editor with the Sunday Times Irish edition for many years. And she has previously written gardening books, The Irish Garden, which was named Inspirational Book of the Year at the Garden Media Awards. And her other gardening book, The Living Garden, which is still available. I'm not sure if it's in print, but it's still available. So we have lots to talk about in terms of nature and a nature book. It kind of goes hand in hand with gardening. So I'm looking forward to getting into it from that perspective. And yeah, there's lots to talk about. So I think this will be a very good chat. So Jane, you're very, very welcome to Master My Garden Podcast.
Thank you, John. Thanks very much for having me on.
Yeah, so as I said, the book caught my eye, which is your newest book, An Irish Nature Year. It caught my eye a couple of months ago when I saw it. It was released probably in September, was it?
September 17th, that's right.
Brilliant, yeah. So I started to see some social media activity around it at that time, and I've recently got a copy of it. And starting off, the cover art is absolutely fantastic. I believe done by Robert Vaughan.
Yes, yeah. The cover art actually got a mention by Ryan Tuberty not so long ago. So that's quite an endorsement. The cover art and all the illustrations inside, there's several dozen illustrations inside, were all done by Robert Vaughan, who's a young artist who's originally from Dublin, but he's living in Donegal at the moment. And as I understand it, this is his first complete book, but he's contributed to other books in the past and various other illustration projects. And I tell you, he's a man to watch. So Robert Vaughan. Watching.
Yeah, definitely the cover art and the art inside, it really catches the eye. I'm trying to think how to describe it. It's really natural, but very true to life as well.
It is natural, and it's what I like about it is it's very effortless. So it's obviously done by a person who really understands his subject. So, you know, whether it's a dirty, great, huge house spider, or whether it's, you know, a flower or a daisy or a blue tit or a butterfly, I feel that he gets the essential quality of each one of those things, and with minimal fuss. So there aren't a lot of extra brush strokes or lines.
Yeah, I don't know much about art, but it looks really simple, really realistic and very natural. It's gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous cover.
Yeah, thank you.
The book itself is what I describe as a superb coffee table piece. So maybe you could describe the book.
Yeah, it's a nature book. It's called An Irish Nature Year. And so what I've done is I've taken every single day of the year, including February 29th, so that if you're reading it in a leap year, you're not that short.
That's a nice touch.
So, thank you. So it describes what's going on in nature on any given day of the year. So I can't even remember what the entry is for today, but it's to do with robin singing. Yeah. So, I mean, if you open it at today's entry, it'll talk about how robins are beginning to sing, and, you know, why they're singing, they're defending their territory and that sort of thing. Another time you might open it and it'll tell you about what birds are migrating at the moment, coming into Ireland or going out of Ireland, or it'll tell you about what plants are in flower or what berries are doing their things, or if the trees are changing color, or just, you know, 366 little and large things that are happening in nature throughout the year. And I've also included quite a bit of folklore, because we have a very rich Irish folklore, and we have some wonderful collections of folklore, including a schools project during the 1930s, where school children all over Ireland went into their parishes and collected folklore from the older people in their parishes. So it meant that all folklore was collected in the 1930s. So it's really, really valuable. So I've been able to use a lot of, you know, interesting cures and omens and things like that from folklore.
And to pick out, you know, a few, because obviously it's 366 days of really good information and interesting information. There was a couple that really caught my eye. There was the one about the Man of War, what I always thought was a jellyfish.
Oh, the Portuguese Man of War, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I can't, it says siphonophore, I think that's the term. And it's actually a collection of creatures which can only live in conjunction with each other. So it's like it's an organism which is composed of lots of different entities which are irrevocably entangled with each other. So it's not a jellyfish. It's a conglomeration of a whole load of different entities.
Yeah. What was really interesting about that was they all exist as one organism as such, but they each have different functions. So the piece that looks like a jellyfish, I know it's not, but it looks like a jellyfish, might have a job of feeding the whole organism. And another one has the job of passing the venom to fish.
That's right. And then like a third organism or set of organisms would be the float, which is the sail,
yeah,
that you see sticking up over the water. And that's a... It's a separate organism of its own. So
yeah, it's mad, isn't it?
Yeah, nature is completely mad. Yeah.
And there was a couple of others then that caught my eye. I opened the one on buzzards, and again,
yes,
I spoke about buzzards with Niall Hatch, how plentiful they had become in recent years, and I didn't really realize they had become extinct in Ireland, and then they were on Rattle Island and they died out again because of myxomatosis. So
that's right. Yeah, the buzzard, it one of its principal food stuffs is rabbits or hares, and when we were hit with myxomatosis, it meant that its food source was damaged, so it didn't do so well after that. I can't remember when it died out. I think at the beginning of the 20th century, and then there was a very small recolonization, which also died out. And then buzzards then began to coming over again of their own accord. Some of the great raptors have been recolonized here because of various human assistive plans, but the buzzard came here all on its own. And it came first into this current lot of buzzards that we have came first into Northern Ireland, and they've been gradually working their way down the East Coast. And I mean, I remember 20 years ago visiting Mount Stewart Garden in County Down and looking up and seeing a couple of buzzards and thinking, my God, you know, what are those huge big raptors? And well, they were buzzards, and yeah, I'd never seen them in Ireland before. And now, you know, you can just go anywhere, and I mean, one of my local parks is down at Shank Hill, and every time I go there for a walk, I see a buzzard hanging out. So they're one of these great success stories of raptors coming back to live in Ireland. And
yeah, they're very plentiful and quite local to me now. There's quite a few of them actually. It was a weird one, because the morning that I recorded the interview with Niall Hatch, a baby or a young buzzard actually flew into the window of the house, which is very unusual. But it was on the morning that I was doing an interview with Niall from Birdwatch Ireland, which was a strange
coincidence. That was an omen. That wasn't a coincidence. That was an omen.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Yeah, maybe that's what it was. But funny, when I'm dropping my daughter to school and the younger daughter to childminders, there's one that sits on the top of an ESP,
yes,
pole. And it's on every morning, more or less, it's on either one of two ESP,
yes,
poles, and if the buzzer is not there, there's a bit,
yes,
of disappointment in the car. It's,
yeah,
a strange one.
They're a brown, slightly ragged looking bird. You know, like you'll see other birds of prey, like a sparrowhawk. You know, is very neat looking, but buzzards always look as if they had forgotten to iron their feathers in the morning or something. They're always a little bit ragged.
Yeah,
and, you know, I just want to say something about raptors and birds of prey. And that is that, you know, I know an awful lot of people feel that, you know, they're damaging to livestock. And that's one thing that they feel. And another thing that, you know, a lot of people feel is, oh, they're killing all the little songbirds and they don't want them. But the thing is that most birds of prey do not kill. They will not kill livestock. Mostly they do a really, really good job of clearing things like, you know, mice and rats and rabbits. So they don't do any damage to our human environment or our livestock. And the other thing is they come at the top of the top of the, you know, the pyramid of life. And if you have, you know, we have a sparrowhawk visiting our garden, and it's kind of quite dramatic if you ever see her eating somebody that's been feeding at your bird table. But, you know, this is the way nature works. And the reason why little birds such as blue tits and sparrows have so many chicks is because there is a very high rate of attrition. So it's just the way nature works.
Yeah, well, I actually have a sort of a story that backs that up. So I have two very, very active bird feeding stations just off the back of the house. And regularly we would get 20 to 30 goldfinches along with blue tits, sparrows and lots of others. And the feeders that are on it, there's a mixture, but there's one particular feeder that's 16 inches long. So it's a real long feeder. And I was looking out one morning and a sparrowhawk came from overhead and directly down along and kind of flew down along the feeder, crashed the small bird to the ground and took it away in a split second. And I saw that happening maybe twice. But what has happened naturally now is that the birds have stopped feeding on that really long feeder, because that was obviously an ideal launch. I don't know whether you call it, what you call it, but an ideal setting for the sparrowhawk to attack them. So the small birds have actually stopped by their own accord feeding at that at that bird feeder. So there's an 8-inch one right beside it. They're eating that straight away, but they're not going near the big one. So they've figured out already that that's the dangerous feeder.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, a sparrowhawk can fly from a very great distance. It just zeroes in on one particular bird. And so obviously there was a clear path for that sparrowhawk to get you. To get its dinner, basically.
And it's a good example of the way it, like, it balances out. So they've figured out that this is not where we need to be. We wanted the smaller ones. There's less chance. And
exactly.
In terms of the book itself, your own favorite entries in it, is there any that particularly stand out for you?
Not particularly any one entry, but the thing that I just love about so many of the entries and so many things I try to get across is just like the magnificence of nature and the feats that certain creatures or plants can complete, you know, that are just so beyond anything that we would ever imagine. You know, things like, for instance, the swifts, you know, the black birds that come to us at the end of May. I mean, you know, they come from Africa every single year. And they come here for only about 3 months, and they nest in crevices, you know, sometimes under eaves and possibly in swift boxes. But that they can, when they're migrating, they can fly 800 kilometers per day. I mean, I just find that incredible. And also when the swifts are here, if they're, say, you know, I live in Dublin, and say if they're having a poor foraging day in Dublin when they're trying to feed their young, they can just nip over to Wales for for a couple of hours, you know, and then they collect all these insects and, you know, bring them back to their children. I keep anthropomorphizing animals, which is terrible. They bring them back to their chicks. Another thing that I find absolutely amazing is, limpets, those volcano shaped shells that you see on rocks. You know, you look at a limpet and you say, that's just kind of a boring, dull shell. But so what happens, though, you know, when the tide comes in the limpets start kind of moving around, and then they're just scraping away at the algae on the rock, and they're eating that. And they have these teeth, which are known as radulae, with which they scrape away the algae, and they scrape away a little bit of stone every time, bit of rock every time they're scraping. And their teeth are made of a material that is stronger than any man-made fiber. And it's the strongest material in nature. It's stronger than Kevlar, which is what bulletproof vests are made of. And so just that these kind of limpets just are sitting there having the most amazingly strong material in nature, just sitting there and, you know, just not making a big hullabaloo about it or anything. But I just think that that's amazing.
Yeah, there's a story there that, yeah, as you look at it, it looks like pretty much one of the most boring things you could see. But the story behind that is quite incredible. And I suppose what you've just said explains why you can actually almost, it's almost impossible to get them off the rock if you're
exactly
trying to.
Yeah. You know, and, you know, just, so I suppose it's just so many things where I find that there are things in nature that we have no idea what's going on, and that we look at it with our superior human eyes, and we have just no idea what the magnificence, the range, the superlatives that are there right underneath our noses. I mean, another thing, I think it's the entry I have for the 24th of December, about house mice. And, you know, you occasionally, if you ever have mice in your house, you hear them squeaking, you know, occasionally. And those squeaks that you hear are, in fact, the bass notes of the mice. And they have an entire range of voices that you can't even hear. So that what we're hearing is the basso profundo notes. And they have several octaves above that, which we can't hear, and that their voices actually range across 5 octaves, and which is incredible. Like, no human voice can do that except, well, very, very few. Apparently Mariah Carey can, and Axl Rose of Guns N' Roses, you know. There's a mouse, you know, just this little gray thing, and, you know, it's doing that, which I find incredible.
Yeah, that's mad. And is there, this is a weird question, but is there any truth in the rumor that you can't have, or you rarely have, spiders and mice together in a house or an attic?
I've never heard that.
I heard that.
Well, so I can tell you, we've had both. So
so it's not true.
No, we live in a very old house, and we live in an old house on a terrace. And if one of our neighbors gets mice, we get mice. And, you know, we have some of those absolutely gigantic spiders as well.
So there's no truth in that rumor anyway. Maybe tell us a little bit about your other gardening books, because gardening is a huge part of what you do, what you write about, and a huge part of your life as well.
Yeah, well, I was actually a garden writer for nearly 25 years. And I kind of dumped the fence a couple of years ago and started writing about nature rather than gardening, because I used to do a weekly column in the Sunday Times for 7 years. And before that, I did one in the Irish Times for 15 years. And I found that when I was preparing to do my gardening column every week, I just would end up really, really wanting to write about the creatures in the garden, you know, the birds or wild plants, or anyway, it was turning, my gardening column was turning into a nature column. So I just decided, well, this is, I have to give this gardening column over to somebody who will actually write about gardening. So, so I did. So I have written two gardening books. The first one was called The Living Garden, A Place That Works With Nature. And that was published in 2011. And I believe it's out of print now, but you can still get it on Amazon or any sort of secondhand place. And that was how to garden in conjunction with nature. So, you know, just ways of being more sustainable and trying to minimize your chemical use and, you know, growing things that suited the habitat and reusing things and, you know, generally kind of having a fairly small footprint on the world as a gardener. So that was my first book. And my second book...
That kind of gardening... kind of gardening ethos is... I suppose it's becoming more important now. And I see over the last couple of years particularly, there's a huge shift towards that type of gardening. It's probably happening a little bit on an agricultural level as well, and probably needs to happen more. But there is definitely a shift towards that type of gardening, you know, that you're gardening in harmony, whether you want to call it permaculture or whatever, you know, eco-gardening or whatever your phrase is. But there's definitely a move towards that type of gardening.
I think so. I think people are getting more relaxed about minding, you know, about looking after their gardens as well. And younger gardeners coming up, you know, they're happy enough to have ragged edges or not to have the, you know, bowling green lawn and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, I think that's a very positive development in gardening. When I wrote that book, which was nearly 10 years ago, it was beginning to become fashionable, but it was not as mainstream as it is now. So then you asked me about my other book then. Yeah. Was An Irish Garden, and that was a huge, massive coffee table book, which I think weighed 6.5 pounds, and wow. It's 400 pages. It is 400 pages long. It's still in print, and it is a book about all the many gardens in Ireland that are open to the public. So it covers about, I think, 66 gardens. And the photographs were taken by my husband, Jonathan Heshen, who is a very excellent photographer. And we were really, really pleased that that book won the UK Garden Media Guild Award for Inspirational Book of the Year.
Quite an accolade.
In 2015, it was quite an accolade, especially for an Irish book. So, that was
yeah,
wonderful.
Well done.
Thank you. So after I finished that book, which took me 4.5 years, I said, I'm never going to write another book again. But then I found myself as a nature columnist, and I had been writing a daily column in the Times Ireland, which was a print newspaper, which was the Irish edition of the London Times. And it still exists online, but it was a print newspaper for 2 years. And during the 2 years, I wrote a daily column called Nature Notes. And when that paper was withdrawn, after its 2 years, it was withdrawn. It just went entirely online then. The Nature column was suspended then. And I felt that I just felt that I'd done so much work, and that the pieces had reached, you know, not a huge audience. So I've used some of those pieces as the basis for this book, An Irish Nature Year. And I've expanded on some of them and changed some of them and written new pieces. But that's where the idea for this book came from.
Super. Nice evolution on from your daily piece in the paper.
Thank you. And I'm still doing a monthly column in the Sunday Times on nature. So, I haven't written a gardening piece now in a couple of years, and that's fine with me. I mean, I still garden and I work as a garden consultant, but I don't write about gardening at the moment.
Well, just before we move off the garden piece and back to An Irish Nature Year, if you were to give, say, gardeners tips for gardening more in harmony with nature, just even a couple of tips there.
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, one of the main things, I think, if you are a gardener and you want to garden more for nature, is just to try and make a shift in your head and realize that the garden isn't just for us human beings, but it's for all the other earthlings that live there. And I know the term earthling sounds a bit twee or hippie-ish, but I kind of like it because it means we're all part of the same pot of life, and it puts us on a level with, you know, everything else that's living in the garden. So that, I mean, you know, in the summer, like we might be out in the garden for maybe 8 hours a day, you know, on a good day. In the winter, we might be there for 15 minutes or an hour or no minutes. But the creatures and the plants that live in the garden are there full time. So it's their full time home. So really, we have to remember that there's an awful lot going on there that we don't see, and that a lot of our actions can impact the creatures and things that are living there full time.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing.
It's a really interesting way of looking at it. And I hadn't thought about it from that perspective. But yeah, that is a really, really good, solid way of thinking about it. Because, yeah, we are only out there for a very, very short space of time generally. We might spend our Saturday out there in the overall scheme of a week or a year. That's very, very little time. So, yeah, really good way of thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know. Yeah, I mean, when we're inside, you know, binge watching on Netflix, you know, the worms are still out there. You know, they don't have televisions. They don't have somewhere to retreat. So I think that's just something we need to think about. I think that if we can think of our gardens as full-time homes for the other creatures on the planet, and if you think of your garden as being like, you know, a wildlife corridor, this is an idea that used to be quite fashionable. So that if you garden, you know, with an eye to nature, and your neighbor's garden with an eye to nature, as you know, on either side of me, there's quite wild, sympathetic gardens. And, you know, between the three of our gardens, we have an awful lot of nature. So the most obvious thing is to stop using pesticides. That is, you know, weed killers or other toxic chemicals, because you're actually doing a lot of damage to, you know, long-term damage in some cases and short-term damage in other cases. And I know, like, if you go and spray your roses because they're covered in aphids in spring, you know, those aphids are going to go away. But what's also going to go away are the predators who have a longer life cycle than the aphids. So when you spray for your aphids, you're also killing the ladybirds, the hoverfly larvae, the lacewings, which are they are like the lions of the garden. And, you know, they are the creatures that are eating the aphids. Now, the aphids have a very, very short life cycle, so they're going to recover really quickly. But your predators are not going to recover quickly. And so you're going to have another aphid explosion. And you're going to have to spray again. So if you can just hold your breath and wait, you're going to have an aphid explosion. But in the fullness of time, you're going to have the predators are going to arrive, and they will sort those aphids out for you. And, you know, the birds will come along as well, and they will sort them out. So the balance will return. You know, a garden is like a big, complex organism. And if you get enough diversity in it of creatures and of different habitat types, the more things you have in it living and dying and eating each other and getting eaten, the more healthy it is. So, you know, the more you think of it as like a big organism.
It's a very good tip, and it's an almost identical tip to one that Klaas Leitenberger gave on an episode a couple of weeks back. You know, very, very similar. It's very, very, it means that you need to park your current process of finding a pest, spot it away, and you need to park it and trust.
That's
his exact words were trust nature to do its job after a little while.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, nature does, you know, nature can be slow sometimes, but I mean, you know, if you are having, say, an infestation of aphids on your beans or whatever, you know, you can take them off by hand, you know, or just don't grow those beans again. You know, so I mean, don't be trying to grow things that aren't suitable for your climate or your habitat. You know, that's another thing. Another thing I would say is just everything comes from the soil, and the soil is the basis. I'm sure that's something that Klaas Leitenberger said as well, because he's a great organic gardener. I mean, the soil is the foundation, literally, of everything. And so, you know, we want to mind our soil and feed it with nice, you know, homemade compost. And when you're making homemade compost, it means you're recycling everything that goes back you're recycling everything you've taken out of the garden is going back into the garden. So you get this perfect circle of fertility. And so if you have a healthy soil with lots of organic matter in it, it means that you're getting lots of worm activity and other activity from other invertebrates. And so that means that your soil is living, and it's just everything goes from there, you know, so you get a much healthier basis.
Klaas did mention that, but it's funny, over the episodes that topic has come up so often is the topic of soil and having healthy living soil. And so it's a funny thing, because I would say for the most part, now it probably is shifting a little bit, for the most part soil wasn't even considered over the last many number of years in gardening or agriculture for that matter.
No.
So it's good to see that shift, and all of the experts that we talk to are pretty much saying that same thing. So
yes,
it's as a gardener at home, it really is something that you do need to look at, is your soil quality, and to try and keep improving your soil quality by adding this organic matter and digging it into the soil. Yeah.
Or even just layering it on top and letting the worms dig it in for you. Another thing I would say is just don't be so tidy. Like, an awful lot of people, they see a layer of leaves on the soil and it's like, oh my God, the soil is covered with leaves. We have to expose the soil so we can see the nice, I like to see that nice black soil, you know. But by doing that, you're taking its clothes off, you know, and you're leaving the soil naked to be, you know, destroyed by the weather or animals coming along and scuffing it up or whatever. So what you want to do is you want to keep your soil closed. And, you know, in the winter, that might mean putting a mulch on it, or it might mean, you know, even in your vegetable beds, it might mean, I know your people listening to this are going to hate to hear this, but if you leave weeds growing in your vegetable beds over winter, if you don't have mulching material, just leave the soil covered with, you know, if chickweed grows, leave the chickweed, and it'll protect the soil structure. Because, you know, if you look at soil, if you look at beds where the soil has been left uncovered, the soil's just kind of all dry and or all wet or whatever on the top, but there won't be any life in it. Whereas if you have the soil covered, like, you know, say if you did leave it covered in chickweed all winter, and then when you went and pulled that chickweed up in the spring, there'd be like dozens and dozens of little sort of things living there underneath the chickweed. And that's good. They're all good creatures that are adding to the life of the soil. So, you know, those invertebrates that you see in the soil, you know, a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of them might be damaging to plants, but most of them are, they're good for the soil. They're aerating the soil. They're eating the organic material that's in the soil. They're providing food for all the other creatures that are higher up on the chain, including birds, you know, like dunnocks and blackbirds and thrushes. You know, they're always rustling around in leaf litter looking for things.
Yeah.
Another thing I'd say, your gardening listeners are going to hate me, but be less lawn proud, and you know, just you know, what I would say about a lawn or a piece of grass is, you know, as long as it's green and, you know, is somewhere, if you've got kids, for the kids to you know, kick a football around, or, you know, if as long as it's green, it's fine. So I wouldn't worry about, you know, plantain or daisies or even dandelions and clover. I mean, for instance, clover is an absolutely fantastic thing to have in a lawn, because it's incredibly drought proof. You know, if you look at periods when we have drought, you'll see green patches in lawns where all the grass has died away and it's gone all brown. And you'll see these lovely green patches where there's clover. And that's because, you know, it's able to retain moisture in a way that grass isn't. And also because it's got nitrogen fixing nodules on its roots. So that is able to make its own nitrates in order for it to stay green. And also, you know, as anybody who knows anything about bees, is clover is absolutely fantastic for all bees. because, you know, everything from honeybees to bumblebees, long-tongued bumblebees, short-tongued bumblebees, doesn't really matter. They all love clover.
Yeah. And again, it comes back to your point. It's a kind of a shift in mentality, because realistically in, you know, Ireland or the UK or in many other parts of the world, to be fair, if you're trying to keep the perfect or the idea of the perfect lawn, it is very difficult. Between moss and weeds, it is, you know, it's impossible to do it without putting a lot of work and a lot of product onto it. So it is definitely about a mindset shift.
Yes, yes. And if, you know, and if you have, a massive, big expanse of grass, you know, like a lot of country houses in the country, rural houses, you know, they just have huge, massive stretches of grass around them. And I mean, those stretches of grass are just, they're crying out to be made into meadows. And, you know, you can just make a meadow so easily by just, you know, letting the grass grow, mowing it just a couple times a year, taking the clippings off to reduce fertility. You can add yellow rattle if you want, which is a hemiparasitic plant, which it takes some of its nutrition from the roots of grass. So that'll make the grass less robust, and it means that wildflowers then can find a footing in your new meadow. And, you know, you can just, you know, if you keep the edges of your meadow tidy, like if you mow around your meadow and if you mow paths through your meadow, then it doesn't look untidy. It doesn't look like an unmowed mess. It looks like, oh, a meadow.
And somewhere to sit down and read a book. Yeah,
yeah, you know, like to lie on the ground and just see all the, you know, the ox-eye daisies waving in the sky, and, you know, all the creatures visiting them and everything. And also, if you see a house beyond a meadow, if you have a meadow in front of your house, it just sets off a house so beautifully, in a way that, you know, a totally manicured green carpet isn't going to. Now, I know, I'm probably making myself incredibly unpopular now, but
not really. I suppose there is that shift in mindset, and, you know, it might not be everybody's cup of tea, but it's certainly becoming a lot of people's cup of tea. So I don't think it'll be unpopular at all.
Yeah, I mean, and the things, like if you do have wild patches in your garden, you know, be it a meadow or just even a little wild patch in the corner, the amount of interest you will get out of that is amazing, you know, because you'll have butterflies and bees visiting it, and, you know, maybe frogs. And so there's an awful lot to watch. And that's great, you know, especially if you have kids as well, because kids are, I mean, they are so, they're complete blank slates, and they are so, they remember everything they see, and they have such open minds. So, you know, for anybody who has kids, really, you know, get them out in nature, get them out in that ragged corner of your garden as quickly as possible, you know, in order to indoctrinate them, I nearly said, in order to teach them about nature.
To be fair, it's where they naturally want to be.
It is.
We have a 20-month-old here, and I was doing some work out, putting up a polytunnel at the minute, and there was I had a piece of plywood on the ground, which I moved, which left a bare patch of clay underneath. And literally, now this child does not stay quiet for even 10 seconds. So she sat there for, I'd say, 30, 40 minutes, just with a little trowel, just rooting in the clay. Oh. So that's where they want to be, like, you know, it's natural for them.
Oh, I mean, all children, they have a right to play in the mud. You know, it should be one of the rights of children to play in the mud and get absolutely filthy. You know, and because, I mean, their attention span for something like that is kind of phenomenal, and the way that they will get drawn into something like that. I was listening to, no, I was reading an interview with Gabriel Byrne, the actor, a few days ago. And he said that in the interview that he was in awe at how long a child could look at a leaf. Just, you know, the child could just be drawn into the looking at a single leaf, and he wishes that he had some of that still, you know. And I think that we could learn from children in that way.
Yeah, it's quite simplistic, but it is true. They can get so much enjoyment out of something that would seem so
Yes.
You know, I suppose unenjoyable in a way to us. You know, they could, like, playing in the clay for half an hour is.
Yes.
You can't imagine why that would stimulate them, but it does.
But do you not remember playing in the clay when you were a child?
I do, yeah. I do now that you say it, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing.
Yeah, I remember when I was a child, I just remember being hunkered down, you know, so often, just, you know, looking at things and just, you know, the little world that was down there you know, because when you're a child, you're small, you know, and you're much closer to the ground. So, you know, it's easier to access all that.
Yeah, for sure. I noticed in your bio something that caught my eye as well. Obsessed with tomatoes.
Yes.
And you run the annual Totally Terrific Tomato Festival. Now, that's a mouthful, but just tell us a little bit about that. It's an unusual one.
Yeah, I don't run it, but I do help. I volunteer quite a bit.
Oh, sorry, helps to run. Yeah, sorry, it does say that.
Yeah, yeah. I did help. I've been involved with it for, about 6 years now. The Totally Terrific Tomato Festival was actually founded by Nikki Kyle, who's a very well-known organic gardener in North County, Dublin. And she founded it, I'm not really sure, maybe eight or 9 years ago. And it ran for 2 years in a garden centre in North County, Dublin. And then that garden centre closed and the festival just disappeared. And I felt that this was a thing that really shouldn't disappear, because tomatoes are absolutely fantastic and so diverse and so easy to grow, and they're so attractive, and so many people can find a lot of interest in them. So I approached Nikki and said, would she mind if I tried to find a new venue for it? So I did, and we ran it at Kilruthery House in County Wicklow for 2 years. And then after that, the National Botanic Gardens took it over. And so it ran there for 2 years. And then this year we weren't able to have it because of the pandemic. We had it on Facebook. I run the Totally Terrific Tomato Festival Facebook page. So if you're interested in tomatoes, please do like that page. And so I hope we'll have it again. So basically what it is, it's just growers from all over Ireland have brought their tomatoes along to this festival, and we've broken the world record twice with the greatest number of tomatoes in one location. In Ireland, you know, where you have to grow them, you have to grow them indoors or in a polytunnel or a glass house or in the warm corner of your garden. So we had 256 different varieties 1 year and 261 different varieties all at one time. Another year, and
did those world records, just again to go a little bit off topic, did they happen by accident, or did you actually?
We were going for it. Yeah, Dr. Matthew Jebb, who is the director of the National Botanic Gardens in Ireland. He, I wonder, is he competitive? He had read somewhere that there had been 200 and something at some other festival somewhere in the United States. I can't remember where it was. And that was the world record. We beat that twice. And
excellent.
I have to say, it's not in the Guinness Book of Records, because in order to have an adjudicator come to your festival, it costs thousands of euros. So we weren't able to do that. But we have photographic evidence.
So just to come back to the book a little bit before we start to close off. So I'm going to cover it next week. I'm doing an episode on perfect Christmas gifts for gardeners, and that'll definitely feature in there, along with some other books that I recommend. So as we start to finish off, as I say, it's a superb book. Is there anywhere that people can find you, or that you want to people to visit you on online or website or anything like that?
I do have a blog, which I rarely do anything with anymore, but that's called that's One Bean Row. And okay. I'm most active on Twitter, and my handle on Twitter is @powersflowers. So
powersflowers.
Yeah, and I mean I'm on Instagram as well, but I don't well, actually I've got lots of beautiful pictures of tomatoes on Instagram. So it's powers_flowers on Instagram.
Perfect. So, well, I'll put both the handles in the show notes anyway, so they'll be available for people to see there.
Thank you.
It's been a really great chat, very enjoyable. We jumped in lots of different directions, but I like that. It was good. It was very interesting. The book itself is fantastic, and I wish you the very best of luck with that. And Jane, really big thanks for coming on Master My Garden podcast.
Oh, John, thanks so much for having me on.
So that's been this week's episode. A huge thanks for Jane for coming on. It was a really enjoyable chat. And the book itself is fantastic. And as I said, I'm going to add that into an episode I'm covering next week, which is all about Christmas gifts for gardeners. So hopefully it'll give some ideas to you as you try to buy gifts for the gardeners in your lives, or maybe you just want to buy a gift for yourself. But I'm going to cover some nice ideas for gifts for gardeners. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with all your gardening friends, and you can find me on the socials, which is Facebook, Master My Garden, and Instagram, Master My Garden. And if there's ever anything you'd want me to cover, just let me know. You can email me on info@mastermygarden.com. A couple of things happening with Master My Garden at the moment. I'm covering my quite big polytunnel, which will be where I'm going to do all the video and sort of tutorial work for Master My Garden. So that's covered now. The ends are to be finished. So there's lots happening there on that side. And I'm really looking forward to starting to produce video. Again, stepping a bit out of my comfort zone with that because I've never done a video before, but really looking forward to getting into that. So that's just a bit of an update as to some things that are happening in the background. So that's been this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. And until the next time, happy gardening.